Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello. You're listening to Philosophy for Our Times, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of Art and Ideas. The sky is blue, the rain is sporadic, the daffodils are out, and so is my new packet of Puritan. Spring is here, and we want to celebrate it in this month's series of podcasts by talking about new beginnings. In 1859, Charles Darwin changed the course of history forever by publishing On the Origin of Species. In 1872, he published The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, which didn't rock the boat quite so much, but it continues to be a source of controversy in our ongoing scientific debates on evolution, and specifically, how it relates to human psychology. Can evolution explain cultural and social differences? Or do we need something new? Julian Baghini is our host in the debate After Evolution.
The discussion today is about after evolution. And the provocation for this is this sense that we hear a lot about how genes in particular are allegedly responsible for this, that, and the other. I'm not sure how often those claims are made by scientists themselves or over-eager journalists, but nonetheless, that's the message that gets through. And yet, clearly there are huge differences between culture. So if you think about sex differences, for example, if in Scandinavia, men routinely change nappies. In certain other countries in the world, a woman can't even drive a car. So there are huge cultural differences, and how is that, in a sense, compatible with an understanding that genes are the drivers of all sorts of aspects of our behaviour? We have three people here to discuss it with us who are a perfectly assembled cast. To my left, Oliver Curry, lecturer at the Institute of Cognitive and Evolutionary Anthropology at the University of Oxford. To my immediate right, Daniel Everett, who is the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Bentley University, Boston, and the author of Language, the Cultural Tool. And to my far right, Janet Radcliffe-Richards, Oxford Professor of Practical Philosophy at Oxford and the author of Human Nature After Darwin. So to without any further ado, we're going to begin with just 4 minutes sort of setting the stall out, answering the question, can our genes explain why behaviour varies between cultures? So, Oliver, what's your initial thoughts on that?
I think that humans have a range of hardwired, evolved psychological mechanisms that influence many aspects of their behaviour. They also have the ability to, invent new ways of doing things in a whole range of different domains, and that's what we call culture. And the goal of evolutionary psychology is trying to decide which is which. For any given bit of behaviour, is this a product of some ancient evolved mechanism, and or is this something that humans have invented, a new way of doing things? In terms of what can this approach tell us about culture and cultural differences, if the question is, do differences in genes between cultures explain differences in their behaviour? I think the answer is no, it doesn't. And no respectable biologist or evolutionary psychologist thinks that. But I think genes or an evolutionary approach can tell us some other things about culture. So animal behaviourists joke that you can group all behaviour under the four Fs: feeding, fighting, fleeing, and sexual intercourse. And I think, when you think about all the millions of different ways all the different creatures in the world solve these problems, the way that humans do it is within a fairly narrow range. Compared to salmon and fungus and oak trees, humans are doing quite a sort of predictable set of things. They behave more or less the way that you'd expect a social primate to behave. We have families, care for our offspring, form coalitions, form hierarchies, have in-groups and out-groups. Humans do this in sort of extra interesting ways, but it's not sort of baffling or completely surprising from an animal behaviour point of view. So I think in that sense, an evolutionary approach can account for what humans have in common, so what some of the content of their culture is. In addition, even when we talk about evolved hardwired mechanisms, these mechanisms are hardwired to be flexible. They do different things under different conditions, and that's kind of what they're for, to identify what's going on in the world and do the appropriate response. So these mechanisms are likely to do different things under different conditions in different cultures and different places, under different ecological and environmental and social circumstances. And understanding more about those mechanisms can account for a lot of how we vary. On top of that, as I said at the beginning, humans also have this amazing ability to invent new ways of doing things, completely unprecedented, not sort of anticipated by natural selection at all, and that's what we call culture, and that's very hard to predict. And that's what we tend to focus on when we think about cultural differences. But even there, I think evolution can make a psychology can make a contribution in terms of understanding the mechanisms, the software that we use to invent ways of doing things, to share, to in terms of who we copy, who we think is a good role model. So even when it comes to that sort of area of learning and imitation, that's a difficult thing to explain how a biological machine like us manages to do that. It's not easy. So I think an evolutionary approach can help there too. So I think it explains some, quite a lot, but not all of cultural variation.
Daniel?
To me, if we look at the brain and we see the three levels of the brain and different things that are found at the brain and the interactions between lower and higher levels of the brain, we see clear evidence for evolution. The brain is the only organ of the body in which we can actually see the strata of evolution, not that the individual strata are exactly as they were at the dawn of time when they evolved. But at the same time, I think the primary characteristic of the human brain is plasticity, in specifically with regard to the most well-developed ideas on the modules of the brain or hardwiring of the brain, language. I find no evidence whatsoever to support the idea that language is an instinct or that it comes in the genes, or in fact the language instinct book, which has led to a lot of the development of work in evolutionary psychology, has an oxymoron as the title, because something that has to be learned can't be an instinct. So my problems with the idea of hardwiring have to do with the time depth that would be required for evolution, the very idea of instincts and how difficult those are to specify. Like all of us, we can benefit by knowing more and more about more and more, but I think there's been a deficit of work in cross-cultural psychology and cross profoundly different societies. For example, Scandinavians versus British or Saudi Arabians or others, these are fairly similar cultures from the perspective of my work among hunter-gatherers. So we need to do work on more isolated societies that have had much less contact with the outside world to see how they think about some of these things. I find a lot of the talk of hardwiring of behavior analogous to the concept that digestion is hardwired into us. It's certainly the case that our digestion draws on several organs and works in a certain way, but for the evolutionary psychologist who would refer to these as modules, I don't find it useful to talk about digestion as a module of the body. It's a function of various organs. So by and large, I do believe that humans evolved. I think natural selection is responsible for a lot of that. Other possibilities are responsible for other parts of it, perhaps. For example, the physics of cramming so many neurons into the brain could have led to some evolutionary changes. I don't think we know much about genes. No neuroscientist can even say with precision what it means for something to be local in the brain. So our ignorance far exceeds our knowledge, as on most things, and I don't think there is a clear answer one way or the other to these issues right now.
Janet?
I'm often puzzled by the way people from starting talking about evolution, immediately move on to genes and presume very quickly that evolution has produced genes for this and that. One of the areas I've been most concerned with is the matter of sex differences. People just took it for granted for a long time that men and women were entirely different. Then, as scientific work began to develop, people pointed out that we hadn't got controlled experiments, that men and women had been systematically differently treated in cultures, and so we couldn't tell how deep the differences were between the sexes. Now, evolution gives you a completely different direction from which to start asking this question. You can say, look at the physical differences between men and women. Women produce the babies. Men merely get away with a small contribution. Women have to go on feeding the babies. Now, if you're going to be involved in evolution and you need a strategy, a psychological strategy, to make you leave offspring, it immediately becomes clear that there should be, certainly in mammals, a rather different psychology in males and females. The females can only, in our species, produce at most one baby a year, reproducing flat out. A male, if he can get enough cooperative females, can produce any, and keep the other men off, can produce any number. Now, of course culture has changed all this. Of course all kinds of developments have happened. But it's still interesting that we are so radically different physically that you would expect to have a different selection pressure on the sexes. And it would be rather surprising if there weren't some deep-rooted emotional differences in them. And when you find that a lot of the things that have been historically said about the sexes, going back to as long as we've had literature, you suddenly notice that an awful lot of them coincide with what evolution would have predicted. Now, this is only the beginning of the research. Of course, we've got cultural differences between Scandinavia and Saudi Arabia, but might there still be persistent differences in psychology in the Scandinavian male and female? I'm delighted that males are changing nappies and carrying babies around. I think this is a very good thing. I think it's culturally a better thing, but that's because I'm assessing it from a values point of view. I think it's better. But I still think there is a very interesting question, and you can start asking it only when you've got evolutionary theory in the background to direct the questions. So I see it as a new line of approach to empirical science.
Well, one of the things that sort of come out in all those presentations, I think, is the sense that perhaps the focus on genes, there might be an overemphasis on the genetic aspect, particularly of evolution. And one of the things that perhaps that relates to is this idea of hardwiring, which people often talk about hardwiring. Oliver was happy to talk about hardwiring, although he was saying, you know, we're hardwired to be flexible, or a phrase a bit like that. Daniel was more cautious about using the phrase at all. And certainly I think that one of the attractions, perhaps, of genes in the public imagination, and maybe even the scientific imagination, is that it seems to at least provide some sort of mechanism for hardwiring. So if we take those issues to begin with, Oliver, I mean, what do you think? Do you think we make too much of the genes as hardwiring and setting things, or actually, or are we still not actually taking it seriously enough?
Well, I think it depends on which aspect of behavior you're talking about, and I completely agree with Daniel that the biggest conclusion is that we don't know enough about how these things work, and it's an ongoing empirical question to identify which genes do what and what, if any, hardwired mechanisms we have. But I think in some ways the effect of genes is underestimated. I think that most of the work in behavior genetics suggests that about half of the differences between the people in this room are due to differences in genes, with the other half due to environmental factors and other random factors. I think that's not really very surprising. I think brains are a bit like our faces. Everyone's got the same bits, but they all look slightly different, and I think our brains are likely to be similar. So I don't think that's widely known or understood. In other ways, I think the effect of genes is wildly overestimated, because people are responding to a sort of, not exactly a journalistic, but a sort of a folk notion of what genes do, that they are these sort of little magnetic particles that pull people in one direction or the other, or pull their strings, and that's not what genes do at all.
I will say that humans learn as much with their bodies as they learn with their brains. So when we have olfactory experiences, when we walk through the world, when we are hurt or too hot, we're learning things. These are stored in our memory. We learn, just as we talk with our hands and our bodies and not just our mouths, we're an integrative system. And I don't think that this integration and how it works together has been sufficiently studied cross-culturally. And so what is culture? To me, culture is not just the knowledge that we have by living in a particular society, but it is the arrangement of knowledge and the ranking of values that we have. So we learn these things. They're caused by all sorts of things. But I remember the first time I was doing field research in the Amazon, I sat next to a fellow who had a cockroach crawling up his arm, and I said, "What do you call that?" And he picked it up, and he said, "Oh, bite," and he ate it. And I wouldn't have eaten that cockroach. And as I did further work on the people, I realized that they don't have a concept of numbers. They don't have the number one. They don't have any numbers. They don't have words for color. They have no stories. They're all atheists. They have no stories of God, that is. They have no stories of the ancient past. This is a society in which these views are enforced culturally and for which genetic contributions seem to be minimal beyond the embodied cognition of the fact that we all share a common body and therefore learn things similarly. So again, I see genes playing a fairly small background role to a lot of the things that are, to me, most interesting about humans.
Janet, what are your thoughts on this?
I was just trying to think of an analogy because we have difficulties with the way the language works here. But we've all got a similar kind of body. That is, it can be damaged by similar kinds of things. Now, in different societies, in different parts of the world, we're going to learn different kinds of caution because we have to be careful of different kinds of thing. But also in different societies, you will get imaginary dangers. I mean, what science would now say. You get cultural dangers. People are told that this is going to cause harm and such. Now, Darwin's point when he was talking about emotions was that they're subject to the same evolutionary pressures as bodies. Obviously, if you have the same kind of human body, it will respond differently in different environments and it will respond in different cultures. But the same could be true of emotions. Things are quite different in Sweden from the way they are in Saudi Arabia or among your tribe, but there's still an interesting question of whether humans react emotionally to certain complex situations in particular ways, and to what extent that underlying basis of reaction, like the underlying basis of vulnerability to sharp knives, is the same throughout them.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to iai.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
Now, we have a second question. To what extent can a knowledge of biological evolution inform and enrich and help our study of cultural differences? And perhaps because you've done most on cultural diversity, you might want to go first on this.
I routinely get emails from scientists, and have you done genetic testing on these people? Are they really different? And besides the fact that I find that question relatively offensive, I have seen people from these villages who were kidnapped as toddlers or babies raised outside in different societies who grow up with all of the normal range of abilities that Brazilians have of that economic class. So there is a good example of how the genes don't predetermine the, you know, for example, the inability to distinguish numbers or eating cockroaches. These are just things that that culture affects. But I don't think that most people working in the field have a sufficient grasp of the nuances of culture and the power of culture and ranking values. I think we often think of culture as just some amorphous thing, as the philosopher John Searle has referred to, just the background, the knowledge that we all share by being members of a certain society. But it's a lot more structured than that and a lot more powerful than that. And so, for example, among the Pitahā people that I work, there's no recognizable phenotype in terms of color, body shape, or hair, and yet everybody grows to the same height and more or less the same weight. And why is that? Well, I think it has to do with the cultural environment. Boas talked about this years ago, studies of new immigrants to the United States, and then looking at their families after they had been in the U.S. and how the phenotype changed so dramatically. That we have genes is a truism. We all have two arms. We all have certain things we have to accomplish in life. But it's not clear to me what is the neurological basis, for example, of hardwiring. What is the predictability of this? But that genes could cause cultural differences, I find no evidence for whatsoever.
Janet, early on in that intervention, you gestured some, I don't know, surprise, horror, shock. What was it that Daniel said that made you pricked up your ears?
He said he found the question rather offensive. Now, it doesn't seem to me that a scientific question about whether there are genetic differences between people should be regarded as offensive. This is why so much is important in evolution, not in whether you're asking a particular scientific question, which may be perfectly reasonable, but what political and moral inferences you're making from this. And as a philosopher, I find that most of these arguments in evolution go badly wrong because people, whatever the evolutionists say, they will leap to some political conclusion about it. If men are evolved to take more sexual opportunities than women, if women are evolved to be extremely choosy about men, what follows? Does it follow that we shouldn't have social punishments for rape? Certainly not.
What did you find offensive then? Why did you find it offensive?
Because of not the idea that it's possible for there to be genetic differences between isolated populations. I don't find that offensive. I find offensive the idea that they came from people who predicted that all people should have this, and therefore these people must somehow be inferior.
Anybody in the audience on the paleo diet, whatever it's called? Anyone that? Oh, no. This is not very trend-setting here.
Well,
so
I can put my hand up.
You are?
Yeah.
You're on the paleo diet. So just for people who don't know, what is the paleo diet?
Well, it's a diet that argues that humans are healthier if they eat the food that they were designed to eat for millions of years before agriculture and industry came along.
So in practice, that means lots of what? Berries?
It means very uncontroversial things, like it means eating unprocessed food at all possible, natural foods, whole foods.
Okay, so that's a paleo diet. Now, that's sort of a purely physical thing here, but this idea that we have clues as to how we should be, or how we are, stroke how we should be, from looking back to our deep ancestral past is one that pops up psychologically as well. And so I do wonder what each of us makes of that idea. Should we understand ourselves in terms of our deep ancestral past? Is that a key to unlocking secrets about how we tick and maybe telling us something about how we would thrive in the modern world?
Well, I find the paleo diet as useful as the concept of paleo temperature, for example. I don't like to be exposed to very high temperatures or very low temperatures. I have a temperature range that I quite like. I don't need to think that this particular diet that was eaten by my ancient ancestors is good because it was eaten by my ancient ancestors. It's simply that my body has certain properties that I share in common with most mammals, and for the same reason that I have limited toleration to temperature variation, the human body unclothed will die below 65 degrees. That's just the physical limitations of my body. I agree that it's healthy to eat in a different way, but I think it has very little to do with evolved practices of the cultures of my ancestors.
Yeah. Do you find this sort of harking back to our hunter-gatherer times helpful when thinking about how we are thinking today in this room?
Not unless you put it in the context of a wider understanding of evolution, because you have to understand that all evolution does is look back and say, these were the characteristics that enabled this species, this group, to reproduce effectively in this environment. And that depends on who the competitors were and all the rest of it. Now, we do know that if you eat a paleo diet, you probably at that time were a more successful reproducer than somebody. I can't imagine what else they could have eaten. I mean, I don't know. But But the point is, you have to remember that working with evolution isn't a matter of something which makes you as happy and healthy as possible, because evolution might not have hit on the best way to make people happy and healthy, and it might all have depended on who you were competing against, what the climate was like at the time. And the mere fact that evolution produced something doesn't mean we can't, with our enormous advance of science, find a way to do it better.
But I mean, but the general point is the argument is not because people used to eat it, therefore we ought to eat it. It's not that. The point is, considering those that environment, considering those selection pressures, can generate hypotheses about what kinds of biological mechanisms we have, which can be used to identify what might be good and bad foods, and that's so it's a source of hypotheses about how we work and what nutrients we require. But I wanted to make a more a general point, and this goes back to you saying whether it's controversial. It seems to me everyone's an evolutionary psychologist when it comes to every other species on the planet. Everyone's an evolutionary psychologist or an adaptationist even when it comes to most of our bodies, certainly up to the chin. And most people, I suspect even on this panel, are evolutionary psychologists kind of up to maybe just a sort of behind the ears. That our visual system, our motor control system, all this is completely uncontroversial, and there's no other explanation for how this intricate machinery could have come about other than natural selection, and the proof of the pudding's in the eating, but thinking about how natural selection works can generate theories about what to look for, what to investigate, what to expect. The only sort of controversy is this kind of bit at the front, which includes sort of human social behaviour, which we're all passionately feel very strongly about in different ways, and our ability to, as I said, invent new ways of doing things. Let's just keep the controversy in proportion, but it seems to me entirely uncontroversial to look to see whether there is some natural selection has sculpted that bit in the way that we expect it to have sculpted the social psychologies of every other species, I think.
Okay, so just finally then, give you just 30 seconds or something just to sort of say what for you, just to sum up or in any kind of way you'd like.
All right, so the biggest lesson for me here, there are two. First of all, we need to have a more nuanced conception of culture and what it is. Second, we don't know much about how the brain works, and we don't know much about the roots of human behavior, and we're struggling with a great deal of effort to understand these better, and some of us reach different points along the continuum of possible perspectives, but as long as we're committed empirical scientists, we have a way of reaching consensus or saying, if you want to pay attention to that, that's fine, that's not important to me. And so you reach these kinds of conclusions.
Janet?
Right. Science is about discovering the way the world works in terms of causes and effects and so on. The way you start asking your questions will depend on the existing background theory you've got, which is different from values. I mean, they both come in, but it will do that. And evolutionary theory gives us a tremendously powerful tool for asking questions about ourselves that we wouldn't otherwise have thought to ask. But the important thing is that these questions are purely scientific and causal. And one of the problems that we have in discussing evolution is that people still, and I think it's a cognitive mistake, a big cognitive mistake, people still will try to make inferences from the scientific claims about the way they are to claims about the way things ought to be, and they will get angry with the scientific claims because they think they are politically motivated. So the crucial thing is to recognize, I think, this is controversial, but I think since Darwin, we have absolutely got to make Hume's separation between facts and values. We pursue the question of fact absolutely impartially, and then we decide what to do with the values.
Finally, Oliver?
I think the success of evolution psychology is an empirical question. It's going to depend on what the data tell us. I think it's a really good, interesting, promising idea, but there just aren't that many there's not much evolutionary psychology. There's not that many evolutionary psychologists working on it. There's probably a couple of dozen active adaptation-minded psychologists pursuing this research agenda. And if you think a couple of dozen compared to the number of economists or the number of political scientists, it's a very small number of people that have generated an idea that's obviously interesting to a lot of others. It often feels to me that there's more critics of evolution psychology than evolution psychologists themselves. So I hope that through discussions like this, people can sort of put to one side the caricatures of both sides of the argument and contribute or encourage more research, more data, and then we can continue to have more productive discussions like this.
I think the panel have walked the walk as well as talked the talk. They've been absolutely fantastic, clear, and join me in thanking them.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast, which was brought to you by the Institute of Art and Ideas. So what do you think? Is evolutionary psychology a neglected discipline? Or are our cultural differences easily explained by culture? Let us know by tweeting at IAI_TV with the hashtag philosophy for our times.